This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat. Volodymyr Dudovic is the director of the Center for International Studies and a senior research fellow in the Department of International Relations at Odessa National University in Ukraine. He spoke with my colleague, Rebecca Cruz, about the ongoing conflict between Ukraine and Russia.
Professor Volodymyr Dudovic, welcome to Worldviews.
Good to be here.
Well, you are a historian and now more recently a scholar of international relations, and you are also from Ukraine. And so the civil war in Ukraine has been going on for about 3 years. And in February of 2014, we, of course, saw the protests that led to the ouster of the President Yanukovych. Shortly thereafter, in March, we saw Russia take over Crimea. And then the struggle for the Donbass region of Ukraine, we then consequently saw some peace talks, and we haven't really heard all that much about what's going on in this country, but certainly much has been going on. Maybe you can give us an update.
Sure. Well, first of all, in that picture that you've just painted, one important moment was in between February events of 2014 and the start of a struggle for Donbass, and that was the Russian annexation of Crimea.
Of course.
And that was in March of 2014, which was actually the start of Russian aggression against Ukraine, which is ongoing. And that's exactly what we have in Donbass, because a lot of us believe, and I myself among them, is that without Russian interference, there would be no bloodshed in Donbass whatsoever. There would be no single shot being fired. So in many ways, it's a civil war by some formal signs of it, when you actually have one group of Ukrainians shooting at another. But at the same time, it's not a civil war, because it wouldn't be happening without the intervention of one major external player, being the Russian Federation.
And Russia has always been very hesitant to say that they are involved, but we have plenty of evidence to suggest that they are. The plane that was shot down, that was a Russian missile.
That's right. And they have a lot of tanks. You know, they have hundreds of new tanks that are produced by Russia. They have unlimited supply of weaponry coming from Russia, and also Russian volunteers. And at several points of time, apparently, there have been Russian military fighting also in Donbass against Ukrainian troops, and also been involved directly in training their proxies to fight against Ukrainian troops. The funding is coming from Russia, apparently, and that's how it is. The border that the Donbass region has with Russia is beyond Ukraine's control, so we don't know what's going on there. They send convoys all the time across the border, so that's how it is. The fighting is ongoing. Actually, in the middle of February or so, we had late February as well, we had an escalation of fighting over little town of Avdiivka, which was defended by Ukrainian troops and then attacked by pro-Russian troops, which involved a lot of heavy weaponry, actually, like missiles, Grad missiles and stuff like that. The war that we have there is really not a small-scale thing, you know, when you only have, like, gunfights. You actually have airplanes involved, you have tanks, you have armor carriers and stuff like that. So it's really a wide-scale kind of, but still low-intensity, but the big war in the middle of Ukraine. At the same time, Ukraine is trying to achieve much more than just not to lose in this conflict over Donbass. We are trying to come forward with reforms, eradicate corruption, which is an ambitious kind of plan for reforms. The problem of corruption has been there with us for years and years.
How can the government do that while also trying to fight this battle and having the large bear of Russia involved as well?
Yeah, it's a big issue, and it's not easy, and we understand that, and a lot of our friends in the West understand that as well. But people in Ukraine, we also think that you shouldn't just find this war in Donbass as an excuse for not doing enough on domestic front. And the government of Ukraine should do more in terms of proceeding with reforms. And they are proceeding with reforms. It's just that those reforms are not happening as quickly as we would like them to be. There are many extremes often when the people look at the reforms in Ukraine. Some say nothing is changing, and that's not true. Others are saying, trying to paint some kind of rosy situation there, saying everything's fine, which is also not true. So somewhere in the middle, really, between those two extremes, the reforms are ongoing, but there is a lot of hesitations and deviations here and there. Ukrainian government finds itself in a situation when we have to push it in the right direction and force them to do the right thing. By we, I mean the Ukrainian civil society, NGOs, civil activists, and also our friends in the West. So in a way, for the last 3 years, like it's always been, but it's now it's even more critical and even more visible. The Ukrainian civil society is a natural ally of the friends of Ukraine in the West, who on the one hand wouldn't like to abandon Ukraine vis-a-vis Russian aggression, but on the other, understand that Ukraine would be much stronger if successful with those reforms. Because one of the things why Putin is waging that war on Ukraine, if he wants us to fail, so he wants to say that his authoritarian model of what he constructed in Russia is the one which is perfectly fitting for the post-Soviet space. And we are in Ukraine are trying to say, no, we would like to construct a democratic country, transparent one, with good governance, with free media, with free and fair elections. So we're trying to find that war, which is not just about territorial integrity, but more also about the future model for the country.
And civil society has been quite strong in the past decade. In 2004, the first kind of the Orange Revolution, and then here in 2014. Was that always the case in Ukraine, or is that something?
No, not at all. Not at all. Actually, Ukraine has been known for years as a very passive politically country. A lot of people never bothered even to show up at the elections. There was this tradition of overbearing patience with what the government does or doesn't do. Ukraine has been known for very kind of people who are ready to just get along with whatever government is in place. And that's strange in a way that we have these two massive political movements, protest movements. It was in 10 years, first in 2004 and then 2014. Ukrainians kind of woke up in many ways. You know, in the first case, it was a massive falsification with elections. And that Maidan movement, Maidan being a big square in Ukrainian, you know, that was different from what we had 10 years later, because the first Maidan, the Orange Revolution, was bloodless, and it was only about the results of elections. So we had a rerun of elections round, and that was it, end of the political crisis. But then the second Maidan 10 years later was different, because we already had some people who'd been shot dead in Maidan movement, and also then the Russian aggression started right away. So it's different, and that's why a lot of Ukrainians say that the mistake of the first revolution, Orange Revolution, that we had shouldn't be repeated.
You have to stay engaged.
Yes,
have to
we
be
have
mobilized.
To stay engaged, because a lot of people thought we now have a right guy in power, and that's it. He's just going to be delivering, and we're going to just be relaxing, sitting back and enjoying ourselves. But that's not how it was, because Mr. Yushchenko, who got to be president after the Orange Revolution in 2004, you know, he was a kind of weak and timid and decisive leader. He didn't pursue reforms, and everyone got just disappointed and disillusioned. And here in the West, you had Ukraine fatigue for a number of years, and a lot of people said, oh, Ukraine is just hopeless, but we're not trying to say and provide the example of the opposite, that we are not, and the people are being engaged, and there's a lot of public activism in Ukraine right now.
So civil society needs to remain engaged, but you still have this situation where this civil war, for lack of a better word, is happening. Is there any resolution in sight? What's being done by the West, by Russia, by the Ukrainian government to try to end the conflict here?
Well, we're fighting the conflict right now. So the focus on both sides is on not losing and on fighting. And we have a lot of people there in the trenches on the Ukrainian side who are there not necessarily thinking about how to end it, even though they're tired and exhausted by being in those trenches. And we're talking about a lot of people who are in a civil life. They were doing
a lot of civilians.
Yeah, they were doing some other things, and they were not necessarily kind of willing, you know, just to go and fight someone in those trenches. But that's how it was for the last 3 years, and it's ongoing. So it's not a civil war; it's really a Russia-Ukraine conflict. And in many ways, actually, a lot of people think it's probably some kind of a delayed war for independence of Ukraine, because we got our independence back in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. Mm-hmm. So there was no war involved there. But right now, Russia is kind of trying to get some pieces of land from us and actually keep us in a tight leash in their sphere of control. And we're fighting against that. So it's some kind of a liberation war. And also, like I said, it's also about the future for Ukraine and the whole post-Soviet space, for that matter, because Putin is very afraid of Ukraine being successful in democratic transformation. So in many ways, some experts actually call it Ukrainian Soviet Soviet war, meaning that Ukraine is trying to break away from that cycle of post-Soviet corruption and authoritarian models of leadership.
Yeah, and I think one of the other tropes that's been used, or the vantage points that's been used, is which direction will Ukraine go? Will they go west or will they go east? Right. And looking west, you have the European Union, you have NATO. What is the current situation with those organizations and their relationship with Ukraine?
Well, I believe that right now, currently, there is only westward dimension which is open for us, because Putin himself destroyed the eastern option for us. He kind of played with this idea of Ukraine being close to Russia, and in many ways it is. You know, culturally, so there are two countries, two brotherly nations, so to speak, the way they see it in Russia. But often they are abuse their role of big brother, who's been really tough to their smaller brother.
A very harsh history.
Yes, very harsh history, and Ukrainians hardly survive that brotherly hugs of a big brother, so to speak. But that's how they push the story then, and many Ukrainians believe that story, and they wanted Ukraine to be close to Russia in many ways, and maybe be part of Eurasian space mm-hmm. that Russia organized, or the customs union, the post-Soviet space that Russia was also leading this project. But now he's kind of destroyed the whole prospect for that, because right now it's not just about the political elites or the governments of Ukraine, it's about the public, which turned decisively anti-Russia because of this recent aggression in Crimea and ongoing aggression in Donbas as well. So a lot of people who were actually in the pro-Russian camp in Ukraine, they're not anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, so the percentage-wise kind of speaking, in Ukraine, the public attitudes are really strongly now in favor of European Union and NATO. But that doesn't mean that only because of that Ukraine would be able to join any of those two organizations anytime soon, because with the European Union, it's kind of complicated. They had their problems as well with digesting newer members. And now, of course, they struggle with economic crisis for a while, and now with immigration crisis and stuff
and
like
Brexit
that.
And Brexit and all
so,
that.
So, yeah, so they're not in the business of considering any time soon Ukraine's application, not to mention that Ukraine is still not ready on account of various criteria that we need to meet before we actually apply for membership. With NATO, the same thing. You know, the NATO is expanded, but not to include Ukraine. So that's a problem for us because we're not part of that collective security architecture system that is there in NATO. People like myself, we pushed this idea of Ukraine joining NATO for years and years now. Public has been not necessarily decisive on this. People have been divided. A lot of propaganda has been against NATO, pushed by Russia into Ukraine. So the people heard this, a lot of things, kind of stereotypes, bad stereotypes about NATO. Now it's changing as well, because a lot of people now realize suddenly that left alone vis-a-vis Russia, it's definitely asymmetrical conflict. We're much weaker. So to withstand that pressure, we need to go and look for some kind of collective security arrangement. And only NATO right now, these days, can provide that.
So is there some frustration, too, at the response of NATO or of the NATO allies in this situation with Russia? Sanctions have been tried, but some would say they're quite weak. Europe and the United States haven't really been able to do all that much.
There is, Rebecca. There is a frustration. The way I put it usually when I talk about that here in the West and here in this country of the United States is that Ukrainians are kind of fluctuating or kind of moving between, frustration and anger about being left alone vis-a-vis Russia in this conflict, and the other extreme is actually being grateful for the assistance that we received, because we actually received some assistance and financial assistance, primarily directed to the reforms business. So it's not directed to much of helping Ukrainian army, for instance, even though there was some assistance coming from U.S., but just not little weapons. So that's been a big issue that's been debated in this country, even under the previous administration, Obama administration. Should Ukraine receive lethal weapons to defend themselves against Russian aggression? And a lot of people in the administration thought that they should. But then President Obama actually decided against it, thinking something like along the lines that if we provide arms to Ukrainians, that would even create this pretext and the reason for Putin to escalate even more against Ukraine. So we wouldn't actually achieve what we were trying to do while supplying those weapons. So that's a problem. That was a line of thinking with the previous administration.
And the new administration, how are people feeling about that?
The signals that we're getting from the Donald Trump administration are kind of mixed, really, because on the one hand, you have a bunch of people in the administration basically stating their commitment to their position on Ukraine crisis and Ukraine-Russia conflict being unchanged from previous administration. administration, basically, which is very critical of what Russia does to Ukraine. And Vice President Pence said that, you know, the Defense Secretary General Mattis said that, your ambassador in the United Nations, Nikki Haley, said that, and other people did as well. And also the press secretary, Sean Spicer, he mentioned in one of the briefings that President Trump believes that Russia should return Crimea to Ukraine. But then at the same time, we know of Mr. Trump's history of making some pro-Russian, pro-Putin statements, and also kind of ambivalent statements on Ukraine, including that he would consider recognizing Crimea being part of Ukraine, of Russia at some point of time during the campaign. He's been more cautious now, I would say, and restrained since becoming a president in public statements on Ukraine, related to Ukraine. But he seems to be still kind of preoccupied and focused on this idea of making relations with Russia better, which would be a good idea for both Russia and United States and us in Ukraine, because we don't want to be battleground between the hostile West versus hostile Russia. But at what expense? At what conditions? So it all what matters for us is what is the agenda there? What are the conditions in place that would facilitate, that would make it possible, enable a dialogue or a normalization of relations between Ukraine, U.S. And Russia. If that would mean that they would withdraw from Crimea and Donbass, and they would change their attitude in the region, and there are many other steps like what they're doing in Syria as well, so it's not just limited to post-Soviet space, that's one thing. But if we see this country, United States, actually continuing to pursue this idea of normalizing with relations with Russia at the time when Putin is doing what he's doing to Ukraine, that would be a bad thing, I think, ultimately for American interests in the region, but also very dangerous thing, emboldening Putin to do more of adventurous kind of style things towards other smaller countries in the region.
Well, we will definitely have to keep an eye on the Trump administration's relationship with Russia and how that affects Ukraine. And I would also say that we need to keep paying attention to what's going on in Ukraine. In this country, as I said, we haven't been watching as closely as we should, that there is a conflict going on, that people are struggling, dying, and displaced. And
thank you, Rebecca, for doing this and for giving me an opportunity to address these issues.
Wonderful. Well, we will definitely keep in touch. And thank you for joining us today.
It was good to be here.
That's Volodymyr Dudovic. He's the director of the Center for International Studies at Odessa National University in Ukraine. He spoke with Rebecca Cruz. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.